This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Thursday, November 4th, 2021. I'm Caleb Brown. A lot has changed in schooling over the past 2 years. One of the uncomfortable changes is more aggressive surveillance of students from the students' own schools. It raises questions about both privacy and equity. Cato's Neil McCluskey and Julian Sanchez discuss why this is not the steady state we want. Since so many students have had to deal with being at home while being at school in a digital sense, how has that changed how students interact with teachers and how schools interact with young people more broadly?
Well, having students, especially under lockdowns, almost all at home, you've had to have teachers, professors, others learn how to deliver instruction, which includes testing, which includes papers. They've had to learn how to do almost all of that electronically. And for students, that is something of a transition. Many students may not be all that familiar or comfortable with online education, although we saw a growth in online education before COVID-19. For professors, it's often even more difficult, especially some older professors. Some just said under COVID, I'm not doing it. You can put a camera on me sitting in a classroom, but I will not be using, I will not be pioneering, at least for myself, online education. And so it was an adjustment period for a lot of people, and schools had to learn how to do things differently than they had in the past. Probably the most concerning thing was, especially at the K-12 level, we had for the first time public schools and therefore really government officials, if you're even talking about public school teachers, able to peer into kids' houses to see increasingly what they were doing online on their computers. And that led to a whole bunch of pretty novel questions about what sorts of privacy protections are students entitled to, and when do we go from a school to a search, basically, of somebody's home?
All right, Julian, this is a very complicated topic, and we can give some, even government officials sometimes deserve grace. So what are the rules here governing public institutions effectively peeking in on kids at home?
Yeah, I mean, so there's precedent in that about a decade ago in Lower Merion School District in Pennsylvania, there was a school that was, without the knowledge or consent of parents or students, using monitoring software on loaner laptops that students were given, and in some cases were able to take home. And this software, in addition to things you would expect, like being able to try and divine the location of the laptop, had functionality that would take photographs through the webcam and would take screenshots of the laptop in use. And Lower Merion, I think, ended up paying out something in the order of $600,000 in settlements to parents after it was discovered that they had in fact captured tens of thousands of images of students at home, often in their bedrooms, sometimes partially undressed after leaving the shower because they had left the laptop open on their desk, and of course apologized profusely for doing this. They, though, were successful, in substantial part because they had not informed students that were being subjected to this kind of potential surveillance. In some cases, it would be, well, the student hadn't paid the insurance fee to take the laptop home, and so they were treating it as missing, but then they kept taking photographs even when they were well aware of where the laptop was for an extended period. What we're seeing now is that this is being done to a greater extent with sort of the explicit knowledge and presumably consent of students and their families. That is, and there's a couple different types of software really to talk about. I think if you're talking about students at the college and graduate school level, what they're most likely to be familiar with is software like Proctorio or ExamSoft, which is more sort of limited function So spyware, that is to say, this is software designed really primarily to be activated while students are taking tests. So if you're taking, you need to take a remote bar exam or any other kind of timed test, and they want to try and ensure that the student is, you know, essentially sitting there taking it in real time, not getting help, not looking at other sources of information to answer the questions on the test. It does so by trying to monitor them and use various sort of machine learning and AI techniques to try and detect if a student's eyes, you know, go to the wrong place to suggest that they might be cheating. This has come in for a lot of criticism from students and faculty on various grounds. Maybe having less to do with privacy, although there is a measure of that. You're sort of essentially required, if you're working from home, to have a kind of camera view into your home and whatever happens to be in the background. But also on grounds of equity. If you have students who are not neurotypical, right, they may not have, you know, the ability to control tics that might make their eyes go places. And so, you know, you have, and also there's, you know, questions about whether the sort of facial recognition component of this works as well for non-white students. So there are issues of false positives and students being wrongly flagged as cheaters, and this potentially being something that disproportionately affects students who have disabilities or you know, or non-white. But with the sort of K to 12 sector, very often we're, you know, we're talking about much more comprehensive surveillance software packages, like Go Guardian or Lightspeed Systems, that, you know, really do more comprehensive monitoring of what a student is doing. I mean, what websites are they visiting? What keystrokes are they entering? In a way that apparently, at least many administrators and teachers are kind of actively monitoring. You know, they're sort of checking what websites the students are going to in real time. And indeed, some of these companies have developed effectively AI systems to try and flag students who may be experiencing suicidal ideation or self-harm ideation or otherwise be at risk and require some kind of intervention. So their sort of digital activity is not just being monitored physically by students, but being monitored algorithmically with the precise goal of staging interventions for students who the AI determines may be at risk. I know this is something that's done, you know, primarily on computers owned by the school. So this is a kind of condition of getting, a laptop provided by the school itself. But to my mind, this creates some fairly serious equity issues. So we've got a scenario where essentially it's understood students need a kind of home laptop or a laptop that they can take home to be able to, you know, function effectively in their schoolwork. But in schools where, you know, you may have a significant percentage of the school population that's, you know, lower income, does not, you know, have a lot of money to throw around buying spare laptops for the kids. So the expectation is, well, you're going to use a laptop. If your family does not have the money to buy the student their own laptop, effectively, they have very little choice but to use the school provided one, which now means essentially subjecting themselves to this kind of monitoring at home that maybe their more affluent classmates are not subject to.
So, Neil, you know, in the last 2 years, we've seen, of course, dramatic expansion of schools making use of computer technology and digital tech to provide learning services to young people. But even if this hadn't happened, I think there's a very reasonable case to be made that schools would just continue to creep into this area and increase monitoring of young people on school-provided tech or even on the tech that they are just using for school at home that they may own. Is there anybody who's looking at, you know, what the rules ought to be here?
Well, yeah, you're right that what we've seen under COVID is kind of a leap that all of education was forced to take to more online, more electronic provision. But we were seeing more electronic provision before COVID, and we were already seeing these issues about when does the technology become too intrusive. Julian talked about was kind of an infamous example in Pennsylvania of somebody having a school-issued laptop that it turns out the camera was recording what this student was doing. We more broadly see, and you saw this in again in Pennsylvania, but this is not just a Pennsylvania problem, but the Mahanoy cheerleader Supreme Court case where schools were essentially informed of what cheerleaders were saying on their texts to other students, not during school time, not on school equipment, but that violated what they might call community standards or something like that. And so schools have started to have to deal with the electronic world and decide where their authority begins and ends. And that would sound easy maybe to say, well, if it's not in school and it's not school equipment, then the school should have nothing to do with it. But there's also a belief that public schools are supposed to reflect their communities, that they operate in loco parentis. In other words, they're sort of taking the place or operating on the behalf of parents. And many people will say, we saw this in the Mahanoy texting case, saying, well, no, look, we want the schools to punish kids who say things that we consider out of bounds, even if it's just about school activities and not on school equipment, not during school time, because those are our community standards and we want to uphold those standards. So we do have a long sort of percolating issue of schools trying to deal with technology. And then it does go into lots of monitoring of what schools are doing and what students are doing, what they're doing in their homes. And we are now starting to see, I think, more attention to this. Under COVID, we had a few cases of teachers seeing usually toy guns behind a student and then reporting them. And then in some cases, the police were sent to the children's homes and things like that, or the child was suspended. In Louisiana, we saw that, and then legislation was passed saying, look, if you peer into someone's home and you see a toy gun, you can't automatically suspend this student. So we see society now starting to work through what are the limits to what a public school can do based on seeing into someone's home or into their lives through electronics. There are other groups that do this. There's a group called the Electronic Privacy Information Center that has worked on these sorts of privacy issues in schools and out for a long time. But they were sort of, at least within the education space, a bit of a loner. We didn't see as many people involved in this other than, you know, when you use Chromebooks, you have Google collecting information about people. There have been folks who have been worried about it, but not really focused on it. But increasingly, we see people focused on it because COVID has made it a necessity, or at least for a while, it was a necessity for many people to have school officials peering into their homes. These court cases have made it a necessity for courts to deal with it. And assuming that electronic delivery of education stays with us, and we have backed off of it a lot in the current school year with kids returning in person, but assuming it stays with us, we're going to see more of these incidents that'll raise the profile of these kinds of questions onto sort of the social radar. And I think you'll have more groups engaging with this question as that happens.
I think, you know, what's extraordinary reading some accounts I've seen from administrators is how quickly administrators seem to have become acclimated to a level of intrusion on the private activities of students that I would want to think a normal person would sort of recoil at. Beyond, you know, students who maybe unwisely, because they know about this, looking for, pornographic material or anything like that. Administrators have talked about watching students, you know, fill out job applications and do other sorts of, personal activity that, you know, isn't, it seems like it would be none of the administrator's business. Seems like the kind of thing you would want to turn away from. But more than that, I'm concerned about the idea of educating students to themselves expect that level of constant scrutiny. right? I mean, what we teach in schools is not just the subject matter, but also, you know, certain forms of compliance and obedience. And, you know, to some extent, we think of that as, you know, preparing for adult life. You should be, you know, trained to be ready to sit quietly and absorb material for a certain amount of time without acting out. But here we're talking effectively about training them to discipline themselves, even in the privacy of their own homes, in terms of their online activity, to treat it as normal, that would be constantly observed. There would always be someone sort of looking over your digital shoulder. And I think that's, you know, frankly, unhealthy. I think, you know, young people need a domain of, you know, kind of unsurveilled space in order to, you know, sometimes experiment with ideas and thoughts and saying things that, you know, parents and school administrators might not be thrilled about. But it's part of the process of growing up. And so to say, you know, the mode through which now you're going to be able to interact with your peers, again, especially if you're not yourself affluent and able to afford your own technology, is going to be exclusively by this sort of mechanism that is being monitored, you know, A, by administrators, to regardless of whether the particular conduct is relevant to school, but also now by artificial intelligence systems that are constantly checking to see whether you've checked enough boxes to raise concern as someone who might be, you know, engaged in self-harm or some other kind of risk. I think that's creating a kind of panoptic mindset in students, right? I am forever watched. I need to act as though I am always under observation. So I think it's, you know, not necessarily a healthy attitude for people, you know, being raised to take part in a free society.
Niels, anything else?
Yeah, I totally understand and agree to a large extent about, you know, it could be very dangerous to condition kids to think that they always have to assume they're being monitored. But this is one of the constant problems, a perpetual problem in education, and particularly in public schooling, of how do you balance different goods and different concerns? And so if you're one of those administrators and you are monitoring what your students are doing, in part, that's because you are a mandatory reporter under the law. So if you discover that a child is going to do something that can harm themselves or being harmed by someone else, the law says you have to report that. And that's always had some problematic aspects to it, because you report somebody and there's actually nothing wrong, and suddenly their parents become suspect as abusive or neglectful. But you can also understand why those exist, why someone says, look, but so when a child is in school or away from their parents, it's good to have somebody who is watching out for their well-being. So we have these trade-offs there. If we talk about the school administrator who's monitoring how well a student is filling out a college application or whether they're getting it in, arguably that is the job of the school, that the guidance counselor or somebody should be helping those students to get into college. And even the idea that you are being monitored all the time, especially if it's using, for instance, a school-issued laptop, could arguably, you could say, yeah, but that's actually preparing you for the world of work, where if you're at work and you start using your work laptop for inappropriate things, there are ramifications for that. It's not to say that I'm on the side of those arguments or not. It's that they're understandable arguments. Reasonable people can come up with, can fall on either side. And that's why we always have to remember in education, it doesn't have to be you either get one or you get the other and you have no choice. All of these sorts of values differences should be adjudicated in society by people choosing different things based on what they value, allowing different policies to compete against each other. So when it comes to education policy, not to say one side is right or wrong, at least I'm not saying that, when it comes to education policy, we need to give people the freedom to try different arrangements, to weigh differently those goods and bads that are involved in this. And so the answer for education policy remains school choice or educational freedom. Let different educators try different arrangements and allow families to freely choose among them.
I knew we were going to get there.
Of course, I certainly agree with that. But I think for the time being, the status quo, I think we have a situation where, again, there's been an enormous uptick in schools and public schools included providing laptops for students to take home, understandably. So students without, computers at home were not really able to function very well during the pandemic. So it was a sort of a necessity to begin doing this. But the reality then, in fact, for lower income students who don't have an alternative to the public schools realistically available to them is you must, if your parents can't afford their own, you must accept this school provided in your a computer into your home to be able to function adequately and to be able to do your schoolwork and participate. And then therefore you must admit this effectively kind of surveillance device into your home. And that's a really uncomfortable thing to be effectively foisting on at least the lower income students who don't have a realistic alternative.
Neil McCluskey directs the Cato Institute's Center for Educational Freedom. Julian Sanchez is a Cato Senior Fellow. Subscribe to and rate the Cato Daily Podcast pretty much anywhere. And follow us on Twitter @CatoPodcast.